Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. On thin ice, not describing my radio career after yesterday, but it has been a Radio 4 book of the week. It's an explorer's memoir of Siberia, surveillance and survival. It tells a story of, and I got tired of reading the bio on this one, because Charlie Walker, well, I've got Charlie here anyway, so I'll let him explain. Charlie, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on. Great to be here.
Pleasure is all mine. I can tell by the picture I'm getting now, you're obviously somewhere halfway up a mountain, down the Amazon basin, across an ice shelf. So where do we find you on God's green earth this morning, Charlie?
This morning you actually find me at home in London. Marvelous. Disappointing, I'm afraid.
No, listen, that's enough as an adventure as anywhere else these days. Just explain to the boys and girls who may not have come across your quite tiring exploits. Where do we start? Explain how you got bitten by the adventure bug, as it were.
When I was in my early 20s, I set off one day on a bicycle and spent 4.5 years cycling about 70,000 kilometres around Europe, Asia and Africa through 60 countries. And that was a good appetizer for a life of adventure. So when I came back from that, I started writing books about that experience and planning the next journey. And over the last 16 years, I've been off on a number of journeys or expeditions, getting kind of gradually slightly more ambitious in scope, if not in length. 4 years has been a one-off. That led me up to a journey to Siberia in 2022, which is the subject of this new book.
And here comes the most obvious question you're ever going to get asked by anybody in the media. Siberia, it's quite big. Did you actually understand how big it was, how remote, how there's basically nobody there? I know we all know the sort of Trans-Siberian Express, but what inspired you to sort of take on Siberia, as it were?
Well, the vastness and the remoteness was really part of the appeal. The Trans-Siberian Railway, which will take you, I think, 7 days from Moscow to Vladivostok, most of which is crossing Siberia, really just sort of skirts along the very south of Siberia, the relatively habitable part where there's a string of cities kind of quite widely spaced. But I think for a lot of people, and certainly for me, when you sort of picture Russia and Siberia in your head, or when you look at a map of Eurasia, the further north and the further east you go, it sort of peters out into obscurity in the mind's eye. I wanted to go to a region called Yakutia or Sakha Republic, which is this vast region. It's nearly the most northeasterly part of Russia. There's one more region further east, but it is 94% the size of India, so absolutely enormous. But with only 1 million people, most of whom live in the capital city, Yakutsk, which some of your listeners may know from the board game Risk, if at all. So my plan was to get up to this extremely empty area to hike through the boreal forest, which covers 5 million square miles. the numbers sort of boggle the mind, really. And to try and reach various indigenous communities living up there. So indigenous Siberian peoples who were there long before the Russians arrived about four centuries ago. In the depths of winter, when it becomes almost unspeakably cold, suddenly this region becomes counterintuitively more accessible, because all the rivers freeze and form these sort of ice highways through the frozen heart of this enormous continent.
Because that was going to be my question, because if you said Siberia to the man in the street, he might not know where it is, but what you immediately think, frozen wastelands, you're going to think gulags, obviously, inhospitable. But what you said, I would have assumed that you would have gone in the warmer months, but it is the geography. 5 million miles of forest. So it's not just one big ice sheet and a couple of people sort of surviving, by their wit's end. It is topography is varied and daunting.
Yeah, you've sort of put your finger on exactly why I wanted to go there, because I had the same, vagaries of an understanding of that region, which are, it's a place of eternal frost and human you know, unhappiness with all the as many as 3 million people, 18 million people sent off to the gulag. So for most people, Siberia represents exile and banishment and punishment and death. But I was aware that for these small indigenous groups, Siberia represents homeland. So I wanted to go and investigate that because I had this kind of this sort of myopia, I suppose, about what Siberia really was. But also, if you go to this region in the summer, because it's in the permafrost zone, so the ground is frozen, come summer, the snow melts and it doesn't drain away. So in large part, so you've basically got the world's largest sort of peat swamp with mosquitoes, you know, all over the place. So in winter, although very, very cold, and in fact, the my starting point on this trek was just next to the pole of cold, the coldest inhabited settlement where the record low temperature was once logged of -67.8 degrees, which is sort of unthinkably cold. My idea was to start there and head north deeper into the Arctic. So starting above the Arctic Circle.
This is Russia. Presumably you don't just rock up, you know, in St. Petersburg and say, I'm going to head off to the most... I mean, did the Russian authorities look at you... And this is early 2022, is this when you go? So did the Russians look at you and go, like, why do you want to go there?
Possibly to some extent, but probably not initially. I've actually found over the years with different journeys through Russia... That the idea of an expedition or expedizi, as they would say, is quite commonly understood. You know, you turn up and I remember one time skiing in the middle of winter through the Ural Mountains, again up in the Arctic Circle, and I met someone and they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Expedizi," and they went, "Ah, okay, molodets, good boy." And they have this idea of to strive and to suffer. I suppose sort of the suit of stoicism, perhaps. So it is quite an understood thing there. However, 4 days after I arrived in Russia, tragically, Russia invaded Ukraine. And at that point, I then became perhaps a person of interest to the authorities.
So where were you when that happened? Had you set off? Or were you preparing to go? I mean, what was the situation when the news came? And how did you get the news, presumably? Because it must have been a different set of news that you were getting, perhaps, than from what we in the West were getting at the time.
I was still in Yakutsk, the regional capital, when the news broke. I was rushing around the city buying up food supplies for the hike ahead. I remember being in a supermarket, standing in front of a huge banked display of different types of pasta, and I was comparing the various cooking times on different bags when my phone buzzed. And I had an alert from BBC News saying that a full-scale invasion had been launched. I remember feeling immediately claustrophobic and panicky, and I sort of rushed out the shop. And I did consider for a couple of days potentially, you know, leaving, coming home, just playing it safe, heading out of there. But gradually, a combination of feeling I had a lack of proximity. I was more than 3,000 miles from either Kyiv or Moscow or the front lines. I was significantly closer to the North Pole. I was closer to Vancouver than these places. So it felt like I was comfortably or safely distant. But at the same time, I also realized that, you know, unrequested, this quite unique opportunity had fallen in my lap as potentially one of the last Western tourists in Russia to stay and to chart the opinions of normal people and see what they really thought within Russia, ordinary citizens, what they really thought about this new situation, about this war, about this invasion. And I've always been quite a curious character. So curiosity got the better of me. I stayed and hit the river and started hiking.
Were you doing this on your own, by the way? Is this just a solo trip and you've got if you're going to the Arctic, here comes again, I know nothing. If you're going to this region, presumably you've got, you know, thick socks, some Kendall mint cake, a Decathlon tent. I mean, you are dragging or you've got a trolley behind you or you're, as they would say, yomping with this stuff. I mean, what have you got with you, Charlie, at this point?
Yes, I was alone. I had a sled that would pull along behind me. The road I was following was what's known as a zimnik. So it's an ice road cleared on the surface of the frozen river. The river freezes 2 to 3 meters thick, so enough for trucks to drive up and down it. And sled would pull easily along behind me. And in that sled, I had, you know, half a dozen pairs of gloves, a comically enormous sleeping bag, you know, everything you need to survive. I was camping for a week at a time. And roughly once a week, I would arrive in a small village or settlement where I would get a night indoors and then back into the wilderness. And the coldest I logged on my thermometer inside the tent was minus 49 degrees, so fairly cold.
Blimey, O'Reilly. Again, because we don't really, I mean, many of us won't come across, I mean, I'm lucky, I live in southern Spain. I've come in contact with a lot of Russians, especially living in Marbella, but that's a different story. But obviously, here comes obvious statement number 15 in this interview. Russia's a huge country made up of obviously a myriad, a kaleidoscope of ethnic groups. So the people that you were meeting on your happy trails, were they you know, sort of Western Russians who are keeping an eye on things? Were they indigenous people? Were they, you know, what was the sort of makeup of the people you were kind of seeing?
Mostly the latter, but a bit of all of the above, really. The two groups that live in the region, or the two bigger groups that live in the region, are the Sakha, who are a Turkic pastoralist, so pony breeders, cattle breeders, and they, it's believed, were pushed north by Mongol expansion many centuries ago. And the Iveni, who are a reindeer herding people, who, I mean, the human reindeer relationship goes back about 12,000 years now. And these people have practiced animal husbandry with these reindeers, nomadically following the migration of their animals for many centuries, until they were collectivized forcibly into villages by the Bolsheviks shortly after the revolution. So I was interested to see how their lives were today, how they had changed, what remained of their traditional means of existence. And I think I had expected, perhaps naively, that they would be sort of primarily their own peoples and perhaps secondarily Russian citizens. But in reality, what I found on the ground was the inverse of that. And they were, most of them referred to and regarded themselves as Russians first and foremost. And their traditional ethnicities, their traditional cultures were a sort of a present, but a secondary part of their character. But of course, for decades, they've all been consuming the same propaganda via state-controlled radio and TV. It's very remote up there. The villages I passed through had very little internet access, if at all. No running water, no indoor toilets, which makes for an interesting experience at minus 50.
I was about to say yes.
But also, it was interesting and at times quite melancholy, because the villages are gradually depopulating, because understandably and surprisingly, unsurprisingly, the children nowadays, they grow up through school, they get through, through schoolwork, through a little bit of internet access, they get a glimpse of the outside world. And of course, they want to leave the village, move to the city as soon as they can. So in the villages, I found almost no one aged in their 20s. There would be people in their 30s and 40s who had children at school. There would be elderly people, the sort of stalwarts of the Soviet era, and there'd be children. But gradually, the villages' populations are just dwindling down. So I don't know how long these settlements will be viable.
So there's that this sort of melancholic sort of atmosphere as you're walking through these settlements. What was the welcome like? Because, I mean, I've been on the receiving end of Russian hospitality in Spain, and it took me 2 days to recover. Were the people, I mean, are opening, welcoming, or were they like, okay, what are you kind of doing here?
Generally very welcoming. My experience in Russia in the past has been that there's an initial taciturnity that once you scratch past that surface, people are incredibly kind and welcoming, very open-hearted. And I found that again on this journey, and I was welcomed into villages, fed, looked after. Usually I was taken under the wing of women in the village, which made a change from previous experiences in Russia, where the men would get hold of me and then just give me as much vodka as they could possibly manage until we're all a dribbling mess. But it was much more wholesome hanging out with the women and learning about their cultures, singing traditional songs, that kind of thing. But gradually, as the 2 months of my trek, 600-mile trek, unfolded, I became increasingly aware that in each village, as friendly and welcoming as people were, they were also reporting back to the police and to the FSB, which is the KGB's successor agency, that I was there. So my whereabouts, my progress was being tracked by the authorities, which led to a steadily rising paranoia throughout the journey.
Because there you are, you know, you're a young man, you've got all this kit with you. It'd be very easy for a Russian to go, well, what actually is he doing here? You know, you say surveillance. I mean, you ran into some trouble. You were arrested when you were at one point.
Yes. Well, when I reached the end of my hike in this port town up on the north coast of Siberia, which is a place that sort of I struggled to imagine, frankly, geographically. But I mean, the final 2 weeks of the hike, I've been walking over the frozen sea ice. I arrived in Tixi, this port town, and quite quickly I was arrested, taken to court, and without being offered a lawyer or really adequate translation, I was tried and found guilty of a visa violation of, in their words, conducting journalism on a tourist visa. Asking provocative questions about the special military operation, as they term it, which for which they had fabricated witness statements. And most concerningly of all, the third charge was photographing restricted military sites, which sounds very, very close to, if not actually, espionage. Yeah. And so I was flown back down to Yakutsk, the regional capital, where I'd been led to believe that at that point I would find myself a flight and sort of deport myself, leave the country. The punishment for was a fine, a ban from Russia, and to have to leave the country. However, on arrival in Yakutsk at the airport, I was quickly bundled into a minivan, and I asked the kind of bailiff, the guard, where are we going? And he said, we will arrive at the prison in 45 minutes. And that's when, you know, my stomach dropped and I realized, oh, this has actually got a little bit out of hand.
Whoa, sorry, that's my immediate reaction. So, we want people to get the book, and obviously you're in London, so thankfully it worked out well. But obviously you've got Russia in an extreme state of paranoia, and we will be in the prison in 45 minutes. And I know you've been in some scrapes before, but you must have thought that perhaps you shouldn't have got on that bicycle and gone 4.5 months, and maybe you should have just, you know, done your accountancy degree or something. And
you sound like my mother.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, she spoke to me earlier. But how did you mentally get yourself around that? Is number one, and number two, how good was it to leave Russia after that? Then,
getting my head around it was difficult. I mean, the hardest thing was they put me in this cell, and I was in the cell for 24 hours a day. Meals were handed through a hatch in the door. You know, there's no outdoor exercise. Cameras in the ceiling watched my every move, and I was told, "You are here until we deport you." And I said, "How long is that going to be?" And they said, "It could be days, could be weeks, could be months." And just the hardest aspect was counting the days up. If I'd got there and they said, right, you're going to be here for 2 weeks, then I'm sure the first couple of days would have been quite hard. But I would have then kind of, you know, fixed, you know, that target, right? Just 14 days. Oh, just 13 days now, yeah. Counting them down, working through it. Going the other way, the open-endedness of it and the total removal of agency was what was particularly difficult. After 2 weeks, I managed to hire a lawyer by that point, and I was taken back to court to have my appeal heard. And the hope there was that it would be agreed that I could deport myself, i.e. leave immediately under my own steam rather than waiting for the state to deport me. And after about 2.5 minutes of consideration, the judge said, nope, your crimes are too political in nature. And I was sent back to the prison, this time put in a solitary cell. There were more weeks to go. When I finally did get put on a flight and the wheels left the tarmac, you asked how it felt when I finally left Russia. Well, that was the first time, and I've been holding off and trying to hold this back to hold back the dam. Finally, the dam broke, and I just burst into tears on an Emirates flight. You're not meant to get up when the flight's taking off, but it was still banking very, very steeply when I, being very British and embarrassed to cry, started staggering up the uphill aisle to try and get to a loo and sit down and sort of break down into floods of tears in privacy.
Wow. Just unbelievable. So the book itself, I mean, normally I have travel writers and then we got there and they gave us trinkets and we came home and I will never forget the warmth and of the people. Obviously yours is a little bit different. So, I mean, how difficult was it for you to actually write this book and go, but I can't get around that period in solitary. That's just ridiculous. But
writing the book was an interesting experience because although there was that rising undercurrent of paranoia, running through the book and through the communities I was visiting, people were becoming very paranoid as well. Reading back through my journals and remembering the good parts of the trip was great. But when it came to the sort of the prison diaries section, where I had these scrawled notes that I kept on the back of my legal paperwork in the messiest, smallest writing possible to make sure no one could read them, or hopefully no one could read them, I did notice myself sitting in my office here becoming increasingly sort of nervy and uncomfortable and a bit jumpy while writing them. And it put me back into that frame of mind where I'm trying to hide from the cameras and write out my thoughts and feelings in full view of prison guards, etc. So yeah, it was an uncomfortable experience writing it, but I'm very glad I did. And I think and hope that readers are going to love it.
The book is called On Thin Ice. It's by Charlie Walker. People, Charlie, if people want to find you online and say encouraging things to you and nice things, where can they find you?
The first place would probably be Instagram at CW Explore. My website is cwexplore.com. So those are the best places to find me and see what I've been up to and what I'll be up to in the future.
And the book is available via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called On Thin Ice. It's by Charlie Walker. It's been today. Charlie, it's been an absolute eye-opener to speak to you today. Thank you so much for your time today.
Real pleasure. Thanks.